This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
You're listening to Style File, where we cover everything and anything on the business of fashion. I'm Azura Rahman, and for this week's Style Maker, we have jewellery designer Dura Khalil of Dura Jewellery.
The signature pieces are the bracelets, actually. So the bracelets have become a bit of an icon because they are so easy to collect.
After that, Lee Chulin and I will be going over what's made headlines in the fashion industry.
This idea that something needs to be coveted, this idea of exclusivity, but it is what it's based on, and that is what the price tag is based on. And if I can get it anywhere, then I don't want it at all.
And finally, Emma Chong Johnson of Elle Malaysia discusses chokers.
And the thing with this trend is that it's so easy to do because you don't even have to buy a choker. You can literally get like a piece of black ribbon and tie it around your neck.
But first up, our style maker for this week, Dura Khalil. Inspired by her mother, a jewellery connoisseur, Dura began her passion for jewellery designing by learning the art of jewellery manufacturing and diamond grading in America and also in London. Not only that, she's also worked with some of the world's most prestigious and renowned jewellery houses, including Wawat and Tiffany & Co. Armed with her rich and varied experience, she then started her own brand called Dura Jewellery that's described to be essentially classic with a touch of modern edginess using precious and semi-precious materials to decorate each piece. Adeline Cheung caught up with her recently as she shares her passion for precious gemstones and her journey into starting her own jewellery label.
How did it all start?
It started actually with my career at Tiffany & Company. And I suppose prior to that, with Mohawad as well, I kind of landed in the industry because I had found that I had a lot of passion for the industry and I wanted to try out to see if I could actually work towards gaining more interest in the industry. So I started slowly sort of studying a little bit while working for these bigger companies. And then I decided to leave my job and go back to school to study design, manufacturing, as well as a little bit of the business side as well. Mm-hmm. So that's how I started what I actually have today.
You began working in 2006 with brands like Mawad and Tiffany & Co. How has those experiences helped you in building Dura Khalil brand?
Wow, those brands, I feel, have been a strong part of my own brand's DNA in the sense that when you work for big companies, you do end up kind of adopting a lot of their ethics and the way that they mm-hmm. present the products, and it influenced me a lot. And I think I spent more time with Tiffany & Company, so from my pieces, a lot of people are able to pick that up, especially within the industry, because of the, I think, the uniformity of the pieces and kind of just the wearability as well. It's influenced me also in the sense that I'm very conscious of the branding that I put out to the world and, you know, to my clients. And I'm always striving to improve to make sure that my brand is set apart, very recognizable.
Now, you started your own jewelry brand. How would you describe your jewelry brand design and styles?
Yes. So my brand has evolved a lot from the day that I had actually launched it at the end of 2013. I have learned to edit a lot of my collections because I feel that when you represent a brand and you want to convey a certain lifestyle to your client, you know, that makes them want to buy your pieces, mm-hmm. you have to, in a way, train or show them what it is that you have on offer. So I have decided over the last 2 years to really edit down the collections to make it a very capsule-like collection in mm-hmm. the sense, you know, we're focusing on the quality, we're focusing on the availability of the pieces in the different colors. We're also focusing on the appeal of the pieces to be mixed with your own pieces and also to collect them. So we are very much into encouraging our clients to collect the pieces, and the style is very wearable. It is very edgy, I would say, in the sense edgy, but you don't have to be very, very quote-unquote fashionista right. to be able to pull it off.
Now, you have a wide selection of jewelry at the moment. Yeah. What would be your signature piece?
The signature pieces are the bracelets, actually. So the bracelets have become a bit of an icon because they are so easy to collect. And because of the size, it's mm-hmm. easy to present them as gifts as well. And I feel that, you know, in jewelry today at least, everybody is so into stacking and layering and mixing yeah. all the different metal colors. And we have also added finish for men also. So we have started this journey to promote the layering and stacking of our bracelets, and we will continue to do so.
A bespoke commission service is also available at Dura Jewelry. Tell us more on how consumers can actually design their own jewelry.
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, bespoke pieces are normally, and I say, you know, I'm talking about 95% of the time, are jewelry to commemorate and celebrate milestones in the client's life. So we're talking about engagement rings and other significant diamond pieces. If a client is interested to do that with me, then we would just get the process started with an initial consultation, and mm-hmm. then we'll go from there. It's a very personalized service, so it really depends on the client's needs.
You're available in Europe and you have a store in Malaysia as well. Now, we have brands like Pandora, Tiff & Co., Endless Jewelry as well has just landed in Malaysia. Do you see mm-hmm. how competitive the jewelry business are in Malaysia?
Yes, the jewelry industry itself is competitive, not only in Malaysia, worldwide as mm-hmm. well. The client has become really sophisticated in knowing exactly what they want.
And, yeah, because apart from design competitiveness, it's mm-hmm. also price-wise as well, right?
Yes, this is true. I mean, larger companies have the ability to, you know, manufacture perhaps in other countries which are allowing them to enjoy lower price point. And I think that with a lot of consumers these days, it is pretty much a matter of choosing what it is that they want. You know, I think it's fair to say that, yes, it's competitive. However, there is that client who knows that, okay, well, all right, we may have Pandora in every mall, in every department. Mm-hmm. But maybe sometimes people are looking for something different, and people are looking for that new designer that hasn't been quite overexposed. So it is competitive, and it is very, very much then down to the client buying into the story. So mm-hmm. with smaller designers such as myself, it is having that face behind the brand as opposed to just a brand. Mm-hmm. So that's what you're buying into. You're buying into my story. You're buying into what I have put into the DNA of the brand, and you get a face. So I think that's quite nice. I mean, I'm a consumer too, big time, and I'm always looking for the next big thing, as it were.
Yeah. Do you have a team of designers with you?
No, I am actually the only person in the creative
Wow, one-man
team.
Show.
Yes, because I'm very controlling in terms of what I put out to the world. But I do have a business partner who contributes to the actual brand management mm-hmm. of Dura Jewelry, and also PR and distribution and all that. But the design is just me, because I feel that sometimes you are not able to really translate that to someone else in order for them to reproduce. I mean, it is possible. A lot of the big companies have teams, and they basically subscribe to the aesthetic and the brand outline and all that. However, you know, there is something to be said about having a lot of control myself. So, yeah, I would like to remain the only person on the creative team.
To take charge of everything and have to say, right?
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to designing, where do you get your inspiration from for all your collections?
You know, you have called me at the best time ever. I travel a lot, and this time I've been in London now. It's probably the fifth week, and I kind of had a light bulb moment when I realized that actually it is when I'm not looking for inspiration that I find it.
And it just comes to you.
Yes, and it takes me a while, you know, to get into it. It's like, okay, it's raining outside and, you know, I might find myself in a really dark mood. And then I'm thinking, oh, I have a great idea for a new collection, you know, that sort of thing. Or even just the creative kind of roots that I can plant. It might not end up as a piece, you know, within the next 6 months. It might be like a year. But I find my inspiration when I am in a place where I am very familiar with, because I'm very comfortable. So that it comes naturally that way. But I think travel is really important.
That's right. I mean, traveling would actually give you more inspiration, because when you're relaxed, it could just comes to you.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly, yeah.
Let's talk about your collections. Now, Dura Jewelry, you have a few collections, namely Off the Cuff, Spring, Pebble, Chains and Disco. But out of all of them, I mean, which can you say describe your personality best?
My personality, actually, I feel is represented by the chain collection, because at the time that I started the brand, it was pretty much a very personal journey that I had come into, and I felt very liberated by being able to create a line and also to put it out to the world. So the chain collection for me is really important. I always think designers have their favorites, but it doesn't necessarily mean that the other collections are not as important, but it's just that one maiden collection that, you know, will always be in my mind, like for the next 30 years or whatever. So that's my favorite. And I like to see that collection on people because it's a very bold collection and it makes a very strong statement. And you know, it's always nice to see if someone's daring enough to wear your pieces.
Yes, that's right.
In a way that...
What are the materials used to design your jewelry?
For now, I am pretty much focused on sterling silver and gold plating, as well as rhodium plating. And I chose silver because it does allow me to sell at that price point. So I'm comfortable with working with silver, and also the type of pieces that I am designing, it does give you that ability to work with the material to make sure that they're still comfortable and wearable.
Do you have any plans in terms of collaborating with local designers in Malaysia?
Yes, I do have plans in the pipeline, but I work closely with this company called The Good Shop. It's actually a charitable company, and I do believe that we will be involved in fashion shows.
In KL?
Yes. So keep your eyes, you know, open for that. It's going to be with Avenue K.
When in terms of like styling with your accessories, can you give us some styling tips on how you would actually wear Dura jewelry?
Because I had formerly come from a fine jewelry background, so the important thing about styling jewellery for me is to mix fine with some of Dura jewellery, because I do think that it's important to put in strands of DNA from yourself, from pieces that you've had. So let's say you are lucky enough to have a piece from your grandmother and it's a pair of old traditional golden hoops or something like that. You want to wear that, and then you want to then mix that with one of our necklaces, and then our bracelets or a ring. But I think what's important is that everyone is able to create their own style. So we don't want to dictate how it should be styled, but I think that a mix of your own pieces plus our pieces then gives you that unique flavor that only you have. I personally like layering a lot of bracelets because I think it's fun, and I think our bracelets are magnetic. so they're so easy to put on and
take it off as well.
And also for bracelets, everyone can wear bracelets. It's easy. You don't have to have pierced ears.
It just actually brighten up your whole entire outfit, right? With layering with a lot of bracelets.
Exactly, exactly.
Do you have any like new collections coming up?
Yes, we will have a new collection coming up in September. And for those people who have noticed, I do not have any gemstones in my pieces yet. We will be incorporating some gemstones. And in August as well, we do have a very special collaboration with an EcoBox subscription company, which is all the fad right now. I don't know if it's big in Malaysia, but it's big in the US and the UK.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
So we'll be part of a subscription box in the US.
That's nice. Okay.
Which we're very excited about. So that's going to be in August, and it's with a company called Love Goodly. And we're very excited to be part of that.
That's great. Well done. Congratulations.
Thank you.
What would you say is the most important element behind your success?
That would definitely be self-discipline and also motivation to stay on top of things all the time, because I admit that it's a very isolating profession, because you do end up spending a lot of creative time by yourself, and it is something that 300% passion is important. Otherwise, who's going to be steering your ship? And that keeps me going every day.
That's great. Now, finally, what is the next step for Duras Jewelry?
Gosh, I guess the immediate next step is we will be holding a press event in London in September, because it's now time to showcase our pieces to the local buyers and the press here.
Coming up next, we'll have Lee Chui Lin going over the headlines in the fashion industry. Before that though, here's Roses XOXO by Abra, and this was played at JW Anderson's Fall 2016 show in London on Stylefile BFM 89.9. This is Stylefile on BFM 89.9, bringing fashion to you over the airwaves. I'm Azura Rahman, and it's time for Style Scoop with Lee Chui Lin. First up, fighting counterfeit. Now, if you've bought Ferragamo shoes recently, and this came out in The Economist, by the way, it seems that the shoes now come with, on the left shoe sole, it's a passive radio frequency identification tag, an RFID tag, and it gives a response that only an interrogator can send and read. Now, it sounds very complicated, but basically it can identify itself as a genuine shoe, a genuine Ferragamo shoe. So what it says to me is that the kind of length and depth that luxury shoemakers, luxury everything is now taking to make sure that people are getting the real thing, because the counterfeiting industry is so huge at the moment.
And sophisticated.
And sophisticated. You know, we all know of the grade A types, you know, and how many thousand ringgit you have to pay for such counterfeits. We're looking at $461 billion per year. That's the value of the counterfeit market. I mean, that's crazy money, Lynn.
It is crazy. And I don't really know how they're going to fight that, because the thing about the lure of counterfeit is that it's never really faded, has it? Because if anything, they've just upped their game. So you get the look of the item that you want, not at the price of the item that you want. And there's no losing. I mean, if you're not of a particularly moral bent, there's really nothing stopping you from buying into this.
For wanting to buy into the whole luxury lifestyle, isn't it? But that's one side of the story, Lynn. There are people who want to buy the genuine things and then are actually presented with things that are not real. And this happens from one level, from buying from what's supposed to be a reputable seller from eBay, to things actually happening in actual stores, you know, where, you know, we've heard of stories, urban legends or not, where, you know, you've had sales assistants who are in cahoots with people who produce counterfeit goods and are selling these to those who are not aware and are paying for what they think is the real article, is a genuine article.
And it's near impossible to identify, isn't it? I mean, when you start looking at these things, you get down into little things like stitching, mm-hmm. you know, the colour of the thread, the zipper that's used. It's insane. And I was looking at this and thinking, I mean, Godspeed and good luck to all the people fighting counterfeit. And, you know, I wish you joy of it. But I don't know. I just think until it's crazy criminalized and you don't really need that level of legislation on something else in this world, what's going to happen?
What do you think of this step by Ferragamo, though? Putting, you know, a transmitter into your shoes. I don't know how I feel about having a transmitter in my shoe and how much it actually adds to the cost of making the shoe.
That's the thing. And also, I mean, what are we basing this on? So, like, every time I see someone else with Ferragamo shoes, are we both going to whip
scan
out?
Scan them.
Yeah, you know, are we both going to take off our left shoe and be like reverse Cinderellas and go, is this real? Is this a thing? Yeah, and the cost thing, that's actually a really valid point that I hadn't considered. I mean, how much are you adding to my already real shoe in order to prove that it's a real shoe? It's just very odd.
It's insane also because of how people are clamoring such goods, right? In the sense that, you know, of course, social media has a huge part in this, in actually infiltrating everyone's screen as to what you should be wearing and what you shouldn't be wearing. And I think it's kind of come to a head, you know, in the sense that, you know, that people are actually kind of turning the tide against wanting logos, wanting to have something that's easily recognizable, that's to be part of a clique. And this brings me, segues very nicely into my next story, where the luxury fashion has actually lost its luster. This was actually an article that was issued by the Daily Beast. Big name high-end brands like Burberry, Prada and LVMH are in the midst of difficult financial times. People are just not coveting luxury goods as how they used to. And I have kind of been seeing this trend for the past, I don't know, 4 or 5 years, where you see the likes of minimalism really made its way onto the catwalks. You know, Celine, a big brand name that relied heavily on its logo beforehand, had Phoebe Philo as your creative director, and suddenly you had bags with very discreet logos, and then you had other brands that were following suit. And then, you know, fast forward 2 or 3 years and you had the likes of Mansour Gabriel, for example. I mean, $500 US dollar bags were being sold out everywhere. And they are being bought by not just people who can't afford to buy your Gucci's, your Prada's, but people who actually don't want to buy Gucci's and Prada's anymore, but want to buy something that's a bit more discreet, a bit less like everyone else.
It's that, and it's also something else that the article points out that I think is very true, which is that luxury goods are no longer exclusive. They charge exclusive prices, but it's no longer difficult at all to get...
It's so attainable.
It is. You know, it's not hard to get a Louis Vuitton Roly. It's not hard to get anything, actually. I mean, there was a time where you needed to hunt things down, where you needed to really kind of covet things. And I know that this is going to be dismissed as mere fashion frivolity, this idea that something needs to be coveted, this idea of exclusivity, but it is what it's based on. And yep, that is what the price tag is based on. And if I can get it anywhere, then I don't want it at all. You know, it's, there's that element of it.
Well, China has a huge role in this. Obviously, you had the luxury houses increasing their supply to meet the demand for these goods. But there you go. You know, then when you have queues of Chinese shoppers on Hong Kong Island, you know, outside of Chanel, everyone toting the same bag, then it's kind of lost its luster for you. And if it's so highly recognizable, why would you want to be part of that clique? Why not have something that's artisanally made by someone on Etsy with great supple leather? I think that's what the clever girls, the clever fashionistas are looking at.
That's the thing. I might as well just, you know, kind of hole punch 10,000 ringgit and strap it to my shoulder, you know, for all the good that it does me. It really has that same sort of effect. And I don't really know where this is going to go, because I think it just requires such a huge mindset shift for a brand like Chanel, for instance, you know, for brands like Dior, for brands like Louis Vuitton, to make that shift to say, yes, you know what we're doing isn't working and we need to change things up.
And makes me think there's two ways of going about it. If they're pricing themselves out into extinction, is how the article says, you know, basically it's just, it gets to a point where you can't price a bag beyond X anymore. X plus one means the demand will just completely fall, you know. Does it mean that the prices will come down, or do you think it'll be a case of where they will start restricting supply? How would you react to that?
Well, sure, but then there's the whole reselling market as well, right? This is the problem. If you once flooded the market, so fine, you're not giving me a new Chanel boy bag. That's okay. I'll just go on eBay and get one that I like, you know, for whatever price I'm willing to pay. I think that they've kind of talked themselves into a corner on this one. And yeah, it requires a Celine-esque style shift of you kind of rejigging to respond to the market. I think gone are the days, maybe, when luxury brands could dictate the whims of the market. I think now they might be stuck having to respond to the whims of the market.
And you can't see that kind of Celine shift happening in many of the big design houses. You've had so many creative directors coming and going from all the big brands this year, from all the big maisons this year. It'll be interesting to see where fashion because we are in the second part of the noughties, aren't we? Where fashion in 2020 will go from there on. I think there'll be a big shift. And maybe it'll be a case of many small players as opposed to two or three big players. And I think that's the real democratization of not just fashion, but also style.
And that's exciting.
It is exciting. So, you know, we'll be on front row watching that. I hope so, Lynn. For our final story for this week, how Metallica went mainstream, the rise of metal iconography in fashion. Oof, wow. You know, I mean, Ezra Zayat would be thrilled about this.
Yes, he would. I can
He's
see him.
He's finally in style.
It's finally happened.
Okay, that laugh was just a bit too gleeful. But basically, we've got a story coming from Adrenal Fatigue.
Yes.
We have a story that came from Vogue.com, no less, about how heavy metal is in fashion. Now, this is a very interesting story for me in the sense that normally when it comes to fashion, when a certain look from a certain genre of music, be it grunge, be it hip hop, it's also because there's a certain icon that is in vogue or the music of the times. Heavy metal, though, when was the last time it was actually something that's been listened to by, you know, the, not to say the fashion insiders, but by anyone ever, you know, by some...
Big statements.
Oh, big statement there. Oh, sorry, I'm going to ruffle some feathers seeing that it's BFM. But it's basically become, you know, subculture or mainstream culture when you have the likes of Balenciaga, the likes of Vetements who are using metal iconography in their fashion. And this has been picked up by Vogue. So where is this going to go from here on? Are you a fan of heavy metal fashion?
No, in short. And it's not really to do with the look so much as it is to do with me thinking, I don't know how I feel about the appropriation of a subculture into the mainstream.
Here we go, that word again, appropriation.
Appropriation, I know, bringing the big guns. But I'm not convinced by the idea of seeing Gigi Hadid walking down the street wearing a Metallica shirt. You know,
it's so hokey, isn't it?
That's the thing, that there is a level of, maybe appropriation is the wrong word, but there is just a level of inauthenticity.
Being a poser, basically.
That is more or less what I'm getting to. I feel the same way every time I walk into any of the high street fashion labels and see a band shirt. You know, whether it be the Rolling Stones or the Ramones, you know, you see that all the time in Topshop. You see that
all the
Clash.
Time.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and you see that and you think, on the one hand, there's nothing wrong with somebody liking a logo. On the other hand, should you not wear it knowing who they are or what they mean? That's what I mean by appropriation. I just think that it's kind of been grabbed and it's being worn by people who just think, oh, okay, Black Sabbath. What does that mean? Whatever. It's a cool logo.
You reckon Gigi Hadid's not a fan of Black Sabbath then?
You know,
she might just surprise you.
She might. I mean, she's dating a musician, sort of. It's who is to say?
Very loosely translated.
Yeah, so I have an issue with this and I don't do it myself. I mean, the band shirts that I do wear, if I am on trend with this, you know, all the shirts that I do wear are of people that I've been to see live, are of people that I'm a fan of. I would not wear a Metallica shirt, pardon me, Ezra, you know, just because I'm not a fan.
And because it's on the runway of Vetements, for example.
Yeah, but I do think we're going to see a lot of it and there's going to be a lot more, you know, slight rises of anger on my part every time
I would
see
feel quite annoyed. You know, if I was a huge fan of The Clash, for example, and, you know, they had a t-shirt that's been produced by Topshops with the likes of Topshops, and you see a 16-year-old sweet young thing wearing it who has no idea what The Clash is or what punk music is all about, I would feel annoyed. I think people tend to feel that way when it comes to not just their culture, but music is very emotive.
That's the thing. And so when we say iconography, I mean, yes, it's iconic. You know, the type of typeface that's used in metal band sort of logos, it's very, very iconic. It's of a type, it's of a time, and I don't want it in the mainstream. It's not that it doesn't deserve to be there. I don't think the mainstream deserves it. I think that you should earn your music stripes.
Right, right. So, and you know, if it's going to be a $1,000, I mean, you're going to be quite annoyed about it, right?
I mean, the person who bought it should be annoyed by it. Like, I don't even understand. This is one of those things where to be on trend, I mean, it harks back to our DHL conversation last week. If you want to be on trend in a Metallica shirt, buy a Metallica shirt. It'll cost you something like $5 or whatever. And this is one of those moments where I'm just going to have to put my foot down and say, this is dumb.
Be authentic. Go to the origin of the so-called trend. And that's where you begin to understand what's
where
it all about.
From.
Where's it coming from? And, you know, it'll be a far sight cheaper than something that's on the, you know, runway of Balenciaga, for example.
Yes.
Okay, so Lynn has cooled down a bit, and that's the end of our stories for this week on Style Scoop. After the break, we have Emma Chong Johnston, managing editor of Elle Malaysia, breaking down the style trend for chokers.
It's Azura Rahman on Style File. Next up, we have Emma Chong Johnson of Elle Malaysia. It looks like the 90s trend is still here and unabating. And she speaks about the accessory du jour of those times, chokers.
When it comes to choker, thanks to Kendall Jenner, choker trend is a thing right now. Tell us more about it.
Yes, chokers everywhere. So Kendall Jenner, Gigi Hadid, all of those people.
They're rocking it, man.
Yeah, and they look really good. And the thing with this trend is that it's so easy to do because you don't even have to buy a choker. You can literally get like a piece of black ribbon and tie it around your neck. So there's a few different ways that this choker trend has been seen. One is an actual choker, and it's normally some kind of black ribbon. Uh-huh. So it's just like a band. Or there is the type where you tie it around your neck and there's a bow. Mm-hmm. Or there's also that kind of like a skinny scarf trend, which looks like a choker. So you just wrap it around your neck and then leave the ends trailing. Mm-hmm. So yeah, so there are a few different ways to go about it. And it's a very, very simple touch, but it's very kind of the moment now.
But I feel it looks nicer on models. And do you think that, you know, well, to me, you know, when you wear a choker, it kind of makes your neck shorter.
It does.
And it depends on what kind of choker you buy, right?
It does. Yeah, you need... I think if you're blessed with a long neck, like, then yeah, you should definitely try this trend out. But it can be a bit trickier for other people. I think also, and this is going to sound stupid, but you need to try playing around with the placement of your choker on your actual neck. Because obviously, you don't want it like right under your chin, because that's like cutting your head off. You have to play around to see where it looks best. And obviously, you know, you have to see how it works with different necklines, whether you know what you're wearing, a sleeveless top or things like that.
If you want to wear a choker, how do you pair it? What kind of top are we looking at? Or dress?
It's pretty tricky. I think, you know, it needs a lot of experimenting. Obviously, I think you'd stay away from collars, from polo necks, from high necks in general. You want something a little bit lower. I think it looks really good with off-the-shoulder tops, which is a big trend now as well, because obviously there's more kind of like expansive skin to play with. You know, Kendall Jenner wears it with like a deep V, which is also a good look if you're...
That makes you very slim though.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And if you're willing to get the cleavage out, that is also a very flattering look.
And where can we buy into this trend?
All the high street stores have some kind of variation on the choker. Obviously, you can just go and buy some black ribbon and tie it on.
It's easier, right?
Yeah.
Save cost.
If you really want to invest, Dior sent chokers down the SF16 runway, and they're really beautiful. They have like beads and... They're also ribbon-based, but, you know, a little bit more expensive. But they're really lovely, but obviously something to think about a bit more carefully if you want to splash out on it.
Does wearing a choker fits better for during the day or during the night? Can it be a night accessory?
Yeah, I think it is a good nighttime look because it's a little bit more glam. It has that kind of rock and roll look. I don't think it would fly in a lot of offices, also because, you know, it doesn't work with collars. So, yeah, definitely a nighttime or weekend look.
And definitely not a day thing. Right?
I mean, you can wear it in the day, but I think it lends itself better to the night. Yeah.
Right. Do you think this is something to invest in?
I really wouldn't bother spending too much money on it because I think it's going to go away soon.
But just buy a row of ribbons and tie it around your neck.
Yeah, just have fun.
And that was this week's episode of Style File. If you missed any parts of the show, catch up with our podcast on www.bfm.my. And don't forget to like our Facebook page, Style File on BFM 89.9. Before we go though, we leave you with Pilates by Dawn Monique. And this was played at Alexander Wang's Fall 2016 collection in New York. This has been Style File. I'm Azura Rahman on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.